Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How you doing there? It's David. I don't know about you, but I'm kind of sick of Americans at this stage. I must admit, I have never in all my life stayed up, watched polls, listened to American commentary. Never really. American elections came and went. Yeah, I was interested. It was never a big deal. But this time, I was that person who was flicking around American TV channels to see what was the latest. What about you, Ed?
Well, I do that all the time anyway.
That's true.
I love it. Last week was fantastic for me. Like,
this is John's idea of heaven.
I got very little sleep and I had loads of work to do as well. Well, I loved it. And I spent a lot of time looking at Fox News. Now, that is an eye-opener. I don't know, did you get to see any of it?
No, because I don't have it.
Right, yeah. Well, I was looking at it online. But it's an eye-opener into the American psyche. It really is. Let me tell you a couple of things about Fox. Because, first of all, they're all perfectly turned out. All
and coiffed. Botox and big hair.
But they kick off the program with this big gladiatorial music. Like, real, we're going to war type of stuff.
But isn't that its whole thing is we are at war, isn't it? And yeah, we are on one side and you guys on the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And they wheeled on all their Republican guys and they're, you know, really pushing. So what about the fraud and what about the irregularities and
Hunter Biden.
Yeah,
Hunter Biden.
Where's Hunter? Exactly. But amazingly, all of their guests were saying, yeah, well, it is a concern and it's this and it's that and that. But not one of them used the fraud word. Not one of them, which I thought was amazing. So the presenter...
I thought they would be all using the fraud word.
So did I. But they're all leaving the sinking ship.
And they are really, they are like rats leaving that ship, aren't they?
Absolutely. But then the Fox presenter says, can't remember which one he was. He says, yeah, well, that's right. There might not be any evidence now. But if there is, we're going after it. And then they wheel in the next lot, ask the same questions.
So it's just stoking the whole base up
all
the time.
Absolutely, poking the bear.
You know what's funny is I haven't seen Fox News, but I've been on.
It's great.
I've been on Fox News.
Have you?
I was actually on Patrick's Day of 2007, right?
Right.
I was on The Pope's Children, 2008 actually. Pope's Children was published in the States and I was on a book tour, right? And it happened to coincide with Patrick's Day.
But this is long after...
The Irish edition.
Yeah.
But that's what happens is usually a book is published and then an American publisher picks up on it and whatever. And
they finally finish it and go, oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, Jason, it took me 2 years to read that. Anyway, so I turn up. So you're on the circuit. So you're doing CNN, you're doing NBC, you know, it's a whole thing. But Fox is really quite different. So you're in New York and it's, do you know the Radio City building in New York?
Yeah, I know it.
Beside the Rockefeller Center where basically all major news organizations have an office and have a studio. And Fox is completely different in the sense that you go in, if you go to like NBC or even RTE or any of those sort of things, it's quite a chilled sort of relaxed idea. Fox, you're kind of hyped up before you go in, right? And all you see is these stuff shirt Republican guys, right? With big heads.
Heads
like televisions. That's what
gleaming white teeth.
Massively white teeth, you know? And these extraordinarily beautiful women, right?
Yeah.
But they're all full-on mental Republicans, right? So I get on and of course it's Patrick's Day and I'm there talking about it. And of course they want to talk about Patrick's Day. But of course what happened was Bear Stearns collapsed on Patrick's Day 2008.
Oh, okay, right.
So suddenly I end up talking about banks and the whole thing about banking system, whatever. But what was amazing is that even though you're slightly on edge, or maybe because you're slightly on edge, you perform better on Fox.
Right.
You can be quite lethargic in other TV stations, kind of like going through the motions. Whereas in Fox, you're kind of aware that they don't care. You've got a pitch to them. You know,
right.
it's a sales pitch. But it's, I didn't, the reason I didn't watch Fox was, number one, is I find it very hard to find the live thing on the Twitter. When I go on Fox Twitter, I can't find the live thing. So I just see things, right? So I get cross. And the second thing is, I was rooting, obviously, like you were, for Biden. So I didn't want to see the other side.
Oh yeah, no. See, I'm a firm believer in that. You always got to know your enemy.
Exactly.
But let me tell you, just very quickly, the other really interesting part of watching Fox was watching their ads, of which they have ad breaks every 2 minutes.
Yeah, and the ads tell you a hell of a lot about who's watching.
Oh my God, yeah. Like last night is a good example. At least half or more than half of the ads on Fox were medical ads. Like, and not just, you know, get your Nurofen type of stuff. These are like for heavy duty. So for instance...
Which you need most mornings.
Indeed.
Exactly.
But for instance, one of them was for a chemotherapy, a home chemotherapy drug.
That sounds kind of crazy.
Absolutely. The ad was about 2 or 3 minutes long, literally. Going through all the benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And then the last, I'd say, minute of the ad was a list of side effects, like memory loss, diarrhea, loss of appetite, tingling in the fingers. It just went on.
All the things you don't want to happen. But you know what? That's interesting, John. It shows you, number one, who's watching.
Yeah.
But number two, it reveals something much more interesting from an economic side as well, or maybe as interesting, which is how medicine is consumed in the United States. The United States spends 15% of GDP on health, and yet it has the most significant proportion of its population without healthcare. So think about this, right? So it spends a fortune on medicine, a fortune.
Yeah.
And what you have is crazily privatized medicine, so that if you're old and you're watching Fox and you're reasonably well off, or maybe you're middle class, a huge proportion of your income is going to medicine all the time.
And it's also interesting that that correlates with the opioid crisis in America, which is bigger than anywhere else.
I love your tangents. I love your tangents. I'm going for my, you know, did you know, GDP and la la la. And you're like, you're down and dirty, the opioid crisis.
That is the reason.
Louis Theroux is in the room. He's coming in.
But it actually means that over half of Fox's audience are sick.
And old.
And old.
And grumpy and angry.
Yeah.
So let's talk about angry America, because what has been the real takeaway from this election, John, is nobody won. Yeah, Biden won by a whisker. But, you know, the Democrats were hoping this was going to be a plebiscite on Donald Trump and he was going to lose. And then maybe you say, okay, that's over.
Mm.
Trumpism ain't over at all. He's going to reincarnate and he's going to change the American political landscape. Number two is Biden now has got to deal with a Senate which could be Republican dominated. So he's got one hand tied behind his back. So all the things that Biden and the Democrats promised during their own internal party discussions are now not so much on ice, but now he's going to have to deal with Mitch McConnell. He's going to have to do what Obama did and what Clinton did, which is make compromises all the time.
Yeah.
So the sort of the AOC Bernie side that wanted the huge Green New Deal and wanted the idea that we'd have helicopter money, the idea that we'd have MMT and all that stuff with Stephanie Kelly.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all parked because he's going to have to go right down the center. But the one thing is, before the election, John, the big criticism of Biden was that he wasn't charismatic, he wasn't a leader, he was a backroom guy who made deals, who walked across the floor, who was this guy who believed in the bipartisanship. You know this thing in America?
Yeah.
That you have to vote. And everyone said, that's awful because you want a leader. Now, in actual fact, Biden has the qualities that could be absolutely necessary to actually do the deals in the way that maybe other leaders of the Democrats don't have, because he has to do a deal with McConnell. And what you might find, remember we talked last week about triangulation. Remember Clinton? This idea is, how did Clinton get things done when he was dealing with Newt Gingrich?
Yes. Right? Yeah, yeah.
He had to give a little bit. He had to give sops to the Republicans to get his own stuff through. So I think we're going to look at real dirty politics for the next 4 years of horse trading. Yeah. You know, this idea of behind the closed doors, the smoke-filled rooms.
Yeah.
And politics as we used to know it. And that's what Biden's good at. So I think, John, with that in mind, that it's going to be trading, negotiating. Because, like, we can do the Trump stuff, okay? But the more interesting stuff is, what does American politics look like for the next 4 years?
Yeah.
And why don't we go and talk to somebody who was actually in Clinton's cabinet during those 4 years? This is the woman who ran economic policy for Clinton when Clinton was dealing with Newt Gingrich, dealing with all those sort of things. You know, the idea is, how do you run a country when you have one hand tied behind your back?
Yeah.
And you have your opponent, someone like Trump or Gingrich, who is prepared to do anything to block your passage. So the great thing is, we have a mate of mine, Laura Tyson, who was the chairwoman of Clinton's economic advisors.
Wow.
She is professor at Berkeley. She has done everything you can possibly imagine doing in economics. She's in California. It's early morning there. Let's go over to her. Laura, it's gorgeous to have you on the podcast. How are things? You must be feeling pretty okay now about America.
Well, you know, I've always described myself in economics and life as cautiously optimistic. So let me say, rather than elated, jubilant, jumping up and down, all of that, I'm cautiously optimistic.
But I mean, given what could have happened, you know, that you can drop the caution for a while. I mean, Laura, let's get into this. You know, I mean, Irish people, as you know, I mean, you're from an Italian background. You knew Irish people when you were growing up. We have a long, long connection with the United States, like the Italian community.
Yes.
The United States that's presenting itself to us now is a weird creature. It's not something we really get a handle on. What does the last week say about the USA?
I want to say that it's weird for an American like myself as well. The level of divisiveness, which we began to see in 2016, which President Trump has absolutely played upon. It's absolutely played upon. He's not a president of the country. He's the president of his team, only his team. And that has taken what was already growing divisiveness in the United States and set it, it made it more rigid. So I'm surprised as well. You know, one of the people who's written a lot on this is Ezra Klein. And Ezra wrote a very good book about why we're divided before this election. And you know, what you see is people have their religious affiliation and their party affiliation and their class affiliation and their social affiliation all come together in a sense of identity. And then you also have, in that divisiveness, you then have, I think, a very important, unique element, which Europe understands, and the U.S., I think, has understood in its history before, but not recently, and that is the cult of a person. So there is a cult around Donald Trump, but that cult is very strong, and it's not going to go away. So essentially, the next 4 years under a Biden presidency is going to have to try to heal some of that division. It's going to have to try to, and I think the Biden team knows that and is very, and I think you hear Biden all the time talking about he will be a president, not just of the people who elect him, but the people who voted against him. I think he's going to try very, very hard to do that and to do some healing, which is essential as we move out of this divisiveness, very painful, bitter, angry divisiveness into more a greater sense of unity. That's going to be a real challenge for the new president, President Biden.
So if we go back 25 years, you are the chair of Clinton's economics advisors. America is the wealthiest country in the world. It's the most technologically savvy country in the world. It has the biggest military. At that stage, it was the only superpower. The Soviet Union had collapsed. It was gone. It was under Yeltsin. China was emerging, but it's not really threatening everything.
Yeah.
America has all the aces. It has all the cards. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure when you were at Washington, you were aware, like, we're in a unique position. When you look at that 20-odd year period, what happened to create the environment where a demagogue could come through and emerge with like 49% of the vote.
This is not an overwhelming, resounding statement. So I think we have to read the election outcome carefully. What is it saying? What is the message? So in terms of division, if I go back to the mid-1990s and think about what happened, first of all, we had had since about 1980 significant increases in inequality in income and wealth, and they have continued. And so they've driven into the electorate much more class issues, much more kind of economic struggle issue, much more for some of the electorate. We want you, the president, we want you, the administration, to help us. But then you have others who actually, and this was an important theme in this campaign, others who say, watch out, the progressive Democrats want socialism. They want to take away from the people who have made it their income, their rights, their responsibilities. So we have this income inequality issue that is very, very important in terms of what's happened to divisiveness. Along with that, this is probably true in throughout Europe. My understanding is from working with McKinsey, it's true. Growing differences among regions. So instead of having, during the post-war period up to about, let's say, the mid-1990s, regional differences, economic differences were declining. There was more of a convergence into, say, things of per capita income, education levels, ability to invest in entrepreneurial activities. There was a convergence. That started to change. That started to change sometime in the 2000s. It was really exacerbated by the Great Recession, which I think we also need to talk about here, because that was a major force that drove this tendency toward division greater. So, and then just let me say that there is a lot of concern in the United States. It existed back in 1990s. I remember dealing with it, that the loss of good jobs, and those are manufacturing jobs, those are jobs that don't require a college education. Those jobs, those good jobs not requiring a college education, have been declining. People blame that on the government. They blame it on trade. They blame it on trade. And they feel like their positions have not been protected and they're not represented. So there's a lot of underlying longer term structural forces at play here, that the erosion of the middle wage jobs with high school education is a long term trend. The growing income and wealth inequality, a long term trend. The regional divergence of economic prospects has become a longer term trend. We have to try to reverse all of these things.
Imagine you were now sitting with, in the same way as you were sitting with Clinton, imagine you were sitting with Joe Biden now and you said, okay, President, here are the issues. Mm-hmm. We've just laid them out here. We still have enormous capability in this country, right? This is not a country, correct. This is not a country going bust. This is not a Brazil and Argentina. No. This is the United States. No. So we've got all the stuff. We can fix this, right? And I saw something you wrote recently about small businesses and entrepreneurship and startup. If you were to say to Joe Biden, here's a few things we should do on the economic front, on the macro front.
What to do.
What to do, yeah, what to do.
So let's lay out the agenda, assuming he would have the ability to do this, because I think I need to underscore the divided government nature of the U.S., okay? We have a Supreme Court now, which is in the hands of an agenda that is not the agenda that I would want to put forward, okay? We have, and it's very unlikely, even though we might get, it's possible, there are three races now in the Senate that are such that there might be runoffs and we might find ourselves in January with a 50-50 Senate. We could possibly find ourselves, not a flipped one, but a 50-50 one, which is amazing. And then, of course, the vice president has the last vote, so it would be majority. Right. But I just want to start that, because when one gives the president advice, he knows very well, because he spent all those years in the Senate, what he can possibly try to do by executive order and what he's going to have to try to figure out a way to negotiate with the Republican majority or with the 50-50 Senate. That being said, he has identified actually clearly in his economic policy proposals. And by the way, an amazing thing about this, Trump has had none. Trump has had none. There was no Republican Party platform. We do not know what his economic agenda is. He's never said his economic agenda. Biden has laid it out. Okay. So very important to President Biden, and I think maybe because of the dynamics, we'll get this. The Great Recession. It took the U.S. a long time. It took Europe a longer time to get out of the Great Recession. There was a lot of pain imposed on the very people who feel they were disenfranchised, not represented, the system was rigged against them, all of those, okay, because we didn't do enough to address the problem of the Great Recession. It meant very, very slow recoveries. It meant that a lot of the pain lasted for a long period of time in the low-wage sector. Most of the jobs created, for example, in California, after the coming out of this very long Great Recession, you know, it hits in 2008, 2009, the recovery is almost literally takes up to the brink, up to the brink of the coronavirus pandemic. Okay, we just got back. We just got back. And in that process, a lot of those jobs were low-wage jobs and many small business jobs. Small business jobs, I think, are very important. So what does that tell me about the president? Number one, he will, I think, argue, and it may happen. It may happen now because of the dynamics of the Senate. We do need another round of economic stimulus. We need that. We absolutely need that. We need that for the small business community. We need that for the state and local governments. You know, even in Republican cities and Republican states, those governors and mayors are trying to do things for the small business community, just as an example. Or for their community college system, just as an example. But they are largely, particularly the cities, but many states, they have a tremendous budget shortfall now. So they're going to have to start laying off people and cutting back these services. So first is economic stimulus, and the stimulus has to go essentially to help the unemployed, who remain unemployed, help state and local governments. That's what I would put. If we're going to have a business loan program, something like the what's called the PPP, the Payroll Protection Program, that was very, very poorly targeted. It did not, in general, go to the smallest, hardest hit business in the hardest hit sectors. We could do better. We should do better. So that's stimulus. Going forward, Biden's long-run policies, he has a lot of emphasis, which I think is absolutely correct, on infrastructure and tie that to climate change. This is a way to employ a lot of people. And
this is the kind of Green New Deal idea.
That's right. The Green New Deal idea, the more extreme versions of it had guaranteed jobs and guaranteed incomes. It can't be that. But it can be a significant amount of funding for infrastructure and for green technological development and for green educational programs and for any policies that promote the use of alternative energy. Okay, so I think that's a really important area. Another important area that I would say, and this is much harder, I think, well, I won't say much harder, I don't know the politics, would be healthcare and just care in general, because we're headed to a court case outcome in the Supreme Court sometime in the summer of 2021 that I think will basically eviscerate the Affordable Care Act. So all of a sudden we will be without that. We will be without it because we know that the latest, most recently appointed judge has already come out against the ACA.
Okay, because it's again something that Europeans find really hard to get our heads around. The other thing we find hard to get our heads around is when I look at those Trump rallies, right, and the people in the pickup trucks and all those guys, right, and I listen to them, and it's very clear to me that they are the losers in the new world. Mm-hmm. Okay, those are the people who've fallen behind, and that's when Joe Biden says, "Look, we're going to have to represent everything." How do you get to a situation where the losers support policies like low taxes for the very wealthy that reinforce the winners and reinforce their loserdom, and yet they celebrate these policies?
Well, I want to start by saying, again, this is a little bit of the understanding the system in the United States. the overwhelming majority of the population, that's like 65 to 75%, support healthcare. They support Obamacare. They're not opposed to it, okay? They supported the use of face masks in the pandemic. They support it. They support, for example, something that is very threatened now, the right, and obviously an issue has been an issue in Ireland, the right to abortion. The majority of Americans absolutely support the right to choose for women. That's it. But the way our system works, there are vocal minorities, which in certain places, certain regions, certain states, they're enough really as a percentage of the state to carry the state in the election, the senatorial races in the election, and to organize all of these protests and big rallies. Guns is another one. I mean, guns, most Americans, the majority of Americans would like to have much stricter review before someone can buy a gun, much stricter registration, much stricter control of heavy-duty weaponry, which is not what you need for hunting. But then there are the gun control enthusiasts, and again, small minorities in some small minorities overall in the country, but very powerful as a voice, particularly in states, because you got to look at the electoral map and the senatorial map, and then you can see how that happens.
Well, I mean, it is an interesting thing because sometimes, you know, we kind of go along, Laura, thinking, oh, well, the majority rules in most cases. But in actual fact, what you see is small, heavily organized vocal minorities actually rule, because the vast majority of us kind of shrug our shoulders and say, ah, yeah, whatever. And right. These guys set each other.
Yeah. I think it's also the case that it's not helpful in the U.S. given the senatorial representation. So basically you have, think about it, you have a state like California, two senators. You have a state like South Dakota, almost no one can find it right on the map. It's not even as big in population as Los Angeles. It's not even close to the population of Los Angeles, but it's got two senatorial votes. And it's got electoral votes in the presidential races. So that's where you can have essentially, I would say over the last 4 years under President Trump, we have had minority rule. What the Senate and the president want in terms of all of those issues I just talked about were what the president and the Senate wanted something different than what the majority of Americans want. So we have a system which does allow for the capture of the system by minority rule. And that has been part of what we've been living through,
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask you finally before we go, Trumpism,
Yeah. It
doesn't go away. It's still there. Is there a mini Trump, cleverer, smarter? I mean, it's hard not to be clever and smarter. Trump coming along that will take up this mantle, because what it strikes me is that the US is at this real tipping point. It's like it feels like an FDR type tipping point, or 1950s, maybe, you know, JFK, like that the United States is in this massive culture war and it's not going away. And economics might soothe some of the hurt on both sides and either sides. But this idea of you're with us, you're against us, this is my tribe, this is your tribe.
Yeah.
Are you worried that a clever Trump will emerge?
So there's no evidence right now. This has been Trumpism has also been a cult of personality, and the Republican leadership around the country has essentially connected to that rather than develop an alternative voice. It's going to be interesting to see. You know, yesterday the president used the White House podium to make unsubstantiated allegations against the election system and to call for a stopping the vote and to call for a movement to the Supreme Court. These are all serious violations of American norms of government and divided power and all the rest. They are pure Trump. So far, only a limited number of Republicans have said anything about this. Okay, they just have not come out and said, no, we're for Trumpism. We're for the kind of government that we, the Senate, have been working with you, or we, the Republican governors, have been working with you. We're for that, but we're not for you, because you are basically misstating, misusing, personalizing the institutions of government in an unethical and violative way, an illegal way. But what you see is so far, there isn't, no one is rising to sort of take this as, okay, you are not doing the right thing. You need to go, but we need to continue with your agenda. There's no voice so far that has come forth. So I can't see that right now, but I can see the policy agenda associated with Trump continuing where you don't have the ability to use the Senate to sort of change that agenda. So will we be able to, someone talked the other day about how they had read Secretary Pompeo's speech from a year ago, basically talking about the environmental risk to national security coming through the melting of the Arctic. Never mentioned climate change once. You cannot actually mention climate change in the current version of Trumpism. Okay, you cannot believe in climate change. Maybe we actually see some Republicans. I know that there's a bipartisan group in the Senate thinking about just exploring a carbon tax. So while I don't see an individual leader coming up to replace Trump right now in Trumpism, I do see the possibility that certain key elements of Trumpism, sort of anti-climate change agenda. There seems to be some Republican leadership around the country and even in the Senate to do something. So let's say Trumpism, we take it apart piece by piece.
A
la carte Trumpism. And of course, that's also about setting the moral tone and moral character of the nation. And I think that is going to be over. That may be the most powerful thing that happened. What the president can stand for and continue to say, I am the president of all of us, that's very important. For the rest of the world, it's very important. It's very important because you have more stability in the intelligence services, in the Justice Department, in the national security arena, which I would say it's not Trumpism. That it's basically you're now, instead of having Trump making foreign policy sort of from his Twitter account, you have people who are thinking hard about, should we have a really good deal between the U.S. and Europe? I think that's going to be an agenda for the Biden administration. How can we repair economic, trade, finance, you name it, relations with Europe? We need to do that. How can we improve? How can we take away the hostility and confrontation of U.S. relations with China? They're going to be complicated. There's always going to be competition. But to go up to sort of the kind of confrontation and conflict that Trump has either threatened or done, I think those things all get adjusted. So elements of Trumpism that are really associated with Trump himself and his personality and his own agenda, I think those elements are going to change. And particularly in foreign policy, where a president has a lot of executive authority and independent authority, I think you can look to major changes. Apparently, a lot of Americans who you thought might have voted for Trump, let's take the Hispanic community, where a surprising minority of the Hispanic community, but a minority, but larger than expected, voted for Trump. What's going on here? It turns out that around the country, there was a concern that about socialism, about communism, about the progressive wing of the Democratic Party was willing to use the term socialist. They really should not, because people don't know the history of socialism, and it connotes a very, very bad thing in the United States. Okay, we spent our entire post-war period fighting against communism and socialism. So that issue of trying to work with people to understand that there can be a role for public policy, say in the healthcare system, which is not socialist. I'm talking about the Democrats, have got to be clear that our commitment is to a private market-driven system. I would use market-driven. And we're not socialists. We are capitalists in the sense that we believe in property and we believe in property rights. But we also believe in an important role for the public sector, where the private sector, even with profit motivation, is not, it's not their job. It's actually not their job to do this. So I feel that if we're talking about lessons from Europe, it's really more lessons about the role of public policy that is not, that's not socialism. I mean, we've got to get in the US, we've got to work, we the Democrats, very, very hard to get rid of that characterization. We've got to, right. And Germany's good. It's a market social, it's a social market system. They don't use the term socialism. They use market. It's right there in their, in the definition, their self-definition. We are a market system. So I think we can learn from Germany.
Laura, listen, it was lovely to talk to you. Really lovely to talk to you. We will have you back in Kilkenomics. It'll be great.
Okay. It was a lot of fun too. As I expected it would be. As I expected it would be.
Brilliant. Listen, we'll talk to you soon. Cheers. Bye.
All right.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Do you know, it's really interesting to actually hear from somebody who is in the room.
Yes, you know, and Laura was.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit like Malgrom's before being in the room with JFK, but actually this is more prescient now. And one of the really interesting things she said there was this whole thing about minority rule. Like, it's something that we've spoken about before, about how these small groups actually have the loudest voice.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, what I love about talking to Laura is the fact that I wish more economists could sound like that. Empathetic. They have done the thing. I mean,
yeah,
she's done it,
yeah,
right? But she's got empathy, humanity. She understands that, you know, what we're talking about is trying to move a massive big ship with a huge amount of vested interests and a huge amount of stakeholders, yeah, right? And how do you do this without inflaming one side, without inflaming the other, making sure you get through the center rather than going to the extremes,
yeah,
and inflaming what is an already inflamed situation? You know, and that's what I think, if economists could strive to that sort of level of wisdom more than anything else.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think the minority rule stuff is really fascinating. Well, I'll just give you a statistic on minority rule, John, about America and the way the system works there, right? Since 1992... 7 out of the last 8 presidential elections, the Democrats have won the popular vote. Think about that.
All right. Okay.
7, including this one. 7 out of the last 8, they've won the popular vote. From 1992 until this year, the Democrats have held the presidency 16 years, and the Republicans have held the presidency for 12 years. And yet,
wow,
almost every case, the Democrats have won the popular vote. So that means, that isn't that amazing?
What does that say about their...
What it says about this, about the
democracy.
Electoral College.
Yes.
It's about this. Yeah. You remember Laura was talking about the fact that Dakota has 2 senators?
Yeah.
Which has got a tiny population, a fraction of the population of LA, and California as a whole, yeah, delivers 2 senators. So therefore...
Right.
Yeah, because every state delivers 2, yeah, right? So therefore, if the senators from Dakota or a small state are captured by a vocal minority, that amplifies profoundly the impact of that vocal minority on the national stage. And it's something that's really fascinated me for a long, long time. When I'm listening to people blithely talk about democracy, And they say, well, you know, the will of the majority. And the assumption is the majority wins and that the majoritarianism is a good thing.
Yeah.
But then you actually look and is that the case?
Yeah.
Does the majority win? And what you actually find in democracies, particularly the way democracies are structured, and particularly PR systems or the American electoral system, is that if you have a vocal minority that can guarantee to a politician maybe 100,000 votes, can guarantee, that suddenly changes that politician. That politician is in your back pocket because you can say, you need 200,000 votes, we can give you 100,000 if you do this, right? Yeah. So if you notice it all over the world, I've always been intrigued, for example, if you look at minorities in every area. Like if you think about the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks,
yeah.
right? Do you remember that? There was a big fight between... Mensheviks were actually the bigger party, but right. the Bolsheviks won through. Why? Because sometimes a small, really committed, ideologically radical element will always have that extra impulse to do their thing. And you see it all over the place. Look at planning in Dublin, right?
But
planning
this, in Ireland. But this is the power of the lobbyists.
It's absolutely the power of the lobbyists. Well, not just the lobbyists. It's the power of those coalitions that can be built, that can guarantee a certain X amount of votes for a politician. Take, for example, Ireland. I've always said the most powerful political organisation here in this part of the world is a well-organised residence committee. Right?
Yeah, with a Karen,
with a big clipboard, okay? Now, the reason it is because they can actually bully the politicians into saying, we don't want a school here, we don't want a road here, we don't want a corporation estate within an arse's roar of our backyard, right? And they change things. So whereas the majority of people might say, well, you know, we need a housing to solve the housing problem. These people say, yeah, but not in my backyard. And if enough people say that, you don't solve the problem.
Yeah.
So the minority supersedes the majority. And this is not even a facet of democracy. It's a condition of our modern democracies. So you get to the crazy situations where the Democrats in the United States have won 7 out of the last 8 presidential elections by the popular vote.
Mm.
Yet they've shared the presidency with the Republicans, who've only won 1 popular vote out of the last 8 since 1992.
It's amazing.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, that is incredible. And it's interesting that, and it was the one thing that I was hoping wouldn't happen, but Moscow Mitch got back in. And he's the guy who held up Obama and all Obama's agenda. And he's there again for Biden.
And apparently Obama is a politician who is aloof, remote, but always remains friendly to most people, except for Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Obama won't talk to him. They won't talk to him, which is still now.
That's because when he was elected, when he first entered office, Mitch McConnell said publicly, we're going to make sure that there's a one-term president.
Extraordinary stuff.
Yeah.
But the upside for America, if you're worried about America not being able to function, Joe Biden has all those attributes that are making him much more likely to be able to do a deal with the other side of the house than Obama, or certainly Bernie, or AOC, or even Kamala Harris. In fact, Harris in the Democratic primaries accused Biden of being far too close to Republicans.
Right, yeah.
That he wasn't left enough. And in actual fact now, it may well be that Uncle Joe is the guy to bring people together. So that could be one plus for the Americans.
But what about, what do you think, now that Biden's in power,
yeah,
that the likes of, you know, like the Lincoln Project and those guys are now going to go back to being Republicans. So what's it say about the Democrat Party where there's, you know, they could easily kind of split and so could the Republican Party.
I think you're onto something. Here's a thought, right? Trump ain't going away.
Mm.
But the way in which the Republicans have abandoned him now in what he would see as his time of need,
yeah,
means he's going to be pissed off. He's going to be angry. He's going to go back to where he's most comfortable, his base.
Yeah.
Like he's not a member of the Republican Party. People forget that Trump is not a Republican.
Yeah.
He's a Trumpist, right?
Yeah.
The Republicans grafted themselves onto Trump rather than Trump grafting himself onto the Republicans. So he's a wild card. So imagine that Trump says, okay, I've been robbed not only by the electoral process, but these people who I got into power, Right? The Republicans in the House and the Congress, blah, 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 they rejected me. So I'm going to go and I'm going to pick up the pieces of the Trump former Tea Party campaign.
Yeah.
These, the pickup truck guys, right?
Yeah.
Trumpism, right? And I'm going to do like a Ross Perot. I'm going to go on my own, right? So he breaks away and takes the Tea Party rump with him. But it's not a rump. It's a big, significant. Trump will be emboldened because he has got 70 million people who voted for him or thereabouts. Okay, yeah. Some crazy figure, right? So he's going to be happy that the base is there.
Yeah. Then and their nose is out of joint as well.
Completely. They're all your friends in Fox. Yeah. They're all right, right?
Yeah.
Okay? So you imagine American politics, next four years. Trump splits the Republican Party, goes out on his own. The Republicans then become the party of Lincoln and Eisenhower, which they were, and Bush, right?
Yeah.
Kind of waspy, yeah. Right? They become the party of big business, the party of low taxes, but also the party of this sort of idea of one nation Americans, that they have this big sense, right?
Yeah.
So they're the center right. So the Trump is the radical right populist, then the center right, the party of Lincoln. Okay, that's a split in the right. But also what you're going to see is because Biden, if he has to deal with McConnell all the time, will not be able to deliver on the Bernie AOC agenda of the more what they call progressives.
Yeah.
Because you heard Laura there talking about, it's absolutely imperative as far as she's concerned, and she's a centrist Democrat, to expunge this idea of being socialist. Because socialism, the word socialism,
such a taboo.
Fears, this is why they've come up with the expression progressive.
Yeah.
Progressive is makey uppy. It's just socialism, right? But it doesn't sound as bad because who doesn't like being progressive?
Because the option is forward looking.
Yeah, you can be regressive, backward looking, right? And of course, and you know that I've sat with Bernie up in Vermont and talked to them all about this, and it's been really interesting. But there is a chance they split. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie, AOC, the left.
Yeah.
And they begin to look more like a left wing party, like a Labour Party.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the centre ground. Democrats become the meritocracy party, the party of the reasonably...
The Dems of the America.
But it's also the people who've done well. So it's a weird alliance of Wall Street. Think about it.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley and Hollywood. That's the strangest alliance. And that's what it is.
Yeah.
So you have...
So they're woke Republicans.
They are woke Republicans, exactly. But there is a chance, John. There is a chance that what we have witnessed is the end of the two-party system. And Trump will trigger that. But by shaking out the extreme right from the Republicans, he'll focus in on divisions within the Democratic Party. The Bernie wing are going to be fed up because they're not going to get what they want. And they might end up splitting. Because remember we always said about the left?
They always look for traitors.
They always look for traitors. You're not left enough.
Yes.
You know, they go back to the good book. They go back to the Old Testament of Marx. And they say, I believe that, look, you were solid on five left-wing issues, but on the sixth, you're not left enough. Yes, right?
Sorry,
you're
a traitor.
Or they'll do what every great Irish revolutionary organization has ever done.
What's that?
They come together, because we hate the Brits. They all come together. We can't say, oh, geez, I hate them too. Yeah. Right? And they all sit down, and always in an Irish political movement, the first item on the agenda is always the split. Because one guy splits off, one guy splits here, and at the end of the day, the entire movement atrophies when faced with the responsibility of governance.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.